The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm glad to introduce our guests this evening. For 20 years, Kamika Royal was a middle and high school teacher and a teaching coach for her fellow educators in Baltimore, Washington, D.C., and her hometown of Philadelphia. She is currently an associate professor of urban education at Loyola University, Maryland. Her new book, Not Paved for Us, Black Educators and Public School Reform in Philadelphia, offers an expert analysis of a school system that bears the scars of systemic racism. She'll be joined in conversation this evening with Edwin Mayorga, associate professor in Swarthmore College's Department of Educational Studies and the program in Latin American and Latino Studies, and Sharif El-Makai, director of the Center for Black Educator Development and co-creator of the fellowship, Black Male Educators for Social Justice. Please join me in welcoming our guests to the Free Library.
This is still very weird for me, but thank you. I've worked on this book for 14 years, so sometimes I'm like, is this for real? So I want to start. I wasn't sure how I was going to start this, but I do want to start by acknowledging some people. In the front of the book, I have in here that this is for my great cloud of witnesses. And so as a younger woman, I lost two girlfriends who were also educators. Their names were Maya and Tanya. And it's very important to me to speak their names. And I have a group of elders. So being from Philly, I was raised at Enon Tabernacle Baptist Church on Coulter Street. So long before the big church, I was baptized by Reverend Lamb in the early 1980s, and I was surrounded by these amazing, beautiful Black people who loved my sister and me so much more than I could understand back then. And so some of them are Frances Lysath, and I know there are folks in the room who knew her, Carter Missouri. Him and his wife would feed me when I would go to their house after school. Irene Alexander, who I called my other mother, Miss Teagle. Miss Teagle was a teacher at Emlyn for years. Reverend Leroy Simmons, who I got to talk to and listen to and learn from a lot about what it means to be an African-centered Christian, what it means to be an educator for justice, what it means to fight without ceasing. Doris Shirley, and I'm not going to cry, but Miss Shirley was a counselor at Girls High. Before she was at Girls High, she was at King. She had been a business education. Before she was there, she was at Leeds. She was at South Philly. She participated in the voluntary transfer program for desegregation in 1964. Ms. Shirley was my Sarah. She wrote my letter to become a Delta. When I was in high school and applying to colleges, when I was at Pepper Middle School, Miss Shirley had me come shadow her daughter Darnice at Girls High because she wanted me to choose Girls High over Central. I was like, I can't be over there with all them girls, Miss Shirley. I can't do it. But when I was at Central, I remember my mom taking me to 30th Street Station, and Miss Shirley met us there because I was going to Hampton, Virginia, to spend the weekend with her daughter, who was at Hampton when I was trying to choose colleges, and I yet again didn't choose that one. But I am so richly blessed because of those people and more who just gave me their time and their energy and their love in so many ways, and they didn't have to. Mm. They didn't owe me anything. You know, I was just a little girl at the church on the usher board and on the choir. I want to acknowledge my Aunt Barbara, who I talk about in the intro to my book, my Uncle John's wife, who was the first educator in my family. She was in a pipeline program. We don't have very many of those anymore, but she began as a classroom aide and then became a special education teacher. I need to acknowledge Peter Morrell. Mm-hmm. Peter Morrell was not a Philadelphian. Peter Morrell was an African-centered education psychologist, and he was the former dean. He was the inaugural dean of the School of Education at Loyola University, Maryland. He ran my hiring process for me to get the job I have. And the reason, I don't have any specific loyalty to this to Loyola. I don't. And I know this is on a podcast, but I don't. It's a job. But for 2 years after... You don't have to edit that part. We are very, listen.
Be unapologetic, we are clear. About that.
Nope. Yep. It's a job. I do my job and they send me a check. That's it. But the thing about it is, for 2 years after I graduated from Temple, I was an adjunct. Mm-hmm. And that adjunct pay and that adjunct life. So when I got that job at Loyola, it was Peter who sat me down and told me, like, I want to see you in this position. And Peter ushered me in, and he got sick my first year at Loyola, and he passed away 10 months later. Mm. And so, I'm grateful for those folks who played such a role and did what they needed to do to get me where I needed to be. And I'm just grateful. So this is my book. It's turned out to be the work of my life. This is my 24th year as an educator, and I started this 14 years ago as a doctoral student at Temple University. You know, I haven't told anybody this publicly, but I'm gonna say it here. So the title I do talk about comes from a Maya Angelou poem, Not Paved for Us. The poem is at the front of the book. It's called On Working White Liberals. And I used that poem when I was a senior in high school in the citywide African American History Month oratorical contest. Mm. So 27 years ago. And when I was sitting at 440 North Broad Street and going over the minutes, the stuff I was reading, I was like, this sure sounds like that Maya Angelou poem that I was reading all those years ago. The other thing I like to tell people, y'all see this cover. Isn't this cover beautiful?
Mm-hmm.
This cover is a photo from a black woman, black Philly photographer, Sahar Kasten Hardy. Wonderful photographer. It is Germantown High School. She did a series of photos after the school closures in 2013. My publisher did not want the book. They didn't like the book title. They didn't like it. They said, we don't think people going to know what they're talking about. And I was like, my people going to know what we're talking about when we say not paid for. I don't know what people you think aren't going to know, but my people know. But they also wanted to put a map of New Jersey on the front of my book.
Shots fired.
I'm just saying. I mean, the book has sold very well, so they could be mad, but they'll be okay. But they wanted to put a map on the front, and it was a cute map from Getty Images, and I was like, that's cute. But... you know, it was like the Delaware River, and then it was Camden, and I was like, I'm going to be laughed out of every room I go into. They were like, well, it said Philadelphia when we looked for it, and I was like, I understand, but y'all can't send me home with a map of New Jersey on the front of my book. book, right? Like, who's doing that? I'm like, come on, y'all. They were like, well, we don't know the geography. Well, then maybe you shouldn't pick a map if you don't know the geography, right? So I thank God for Sahara Costin Hardy, who allowed us to use her picture of Germantown High School on the front of the book. And she had no idea. My mother's a graduate of Germantown High School. So my mother's a 1965 graduate. I need to acknowledge that my parents are here. So. So for 14 years, I worked on this book on Black educators and the School District of Philadelphia. And I'm grateful that I'm here to talk to my two friends about this book. So y'all can go ahead.
Well, I mean, I would just say, we're just so proud of Dr. Roy. First of all, like, we were both like, you sure? This is like your moment, you know what I mean? But that's the type of person that she is, you know. And the second thing, Dr. Roy was the first person that I saw wearing one of those, I see it all the time now, but she was the first person I saw that wore Black Women Are for Grown Folks.
Mm-hmm. Grown-ups.
Grown-ups.
Black Women Are for Grown-ups.
Yeah, I got it wrong. Like, and as I was reading the book, I was like, I thought about the shirt. I was like, you know what their research is, too.
Well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think I too, am humbled by the opportunity to be in conversation. And when I was reminding folks to please come out and register on Twitter this morning, I was like, oh, you know, this is a conversation that's also celebration. And I think, you know, I'm not a Philadelphian. My mom always says, she's like, ¿Dónde estás? Ahí estás en la pelota, which is like, you're in the ball, right? And so, like, and that's the approach that I've always felt that has been important to me, is like, wherever I'm at, you know, like, I'm going to drop my bucket, roll up my sleeves, listen, follow the leaders, see what's happening, stay attuned to it. And so I've just felt really blessed to have had the opportunity to, I'm coming on 9 years of living in this community, and I've had the opportunity as a colleague in the field, and as just a human being, it's been an honor to be in community with you, Kamika, Dr. Royal. And I think the book is like that too. And I think, you know, echoing what Sharif has just articulated here is that it feels like it's a dropping of your bucket here in the city that I know you love so much, but that you unapologetically, as James Baldwin has taught us, to critique it because you love it so much. Mm-hmm. And that's what this book feels like, is it feels like a love song to a bird, to a city that is unrelentingly truthful. And I appreciate that as a scholar and just as a reader, right? Like, I mean, listen, y'all, like, reading academic books for a living is like a struggle, but if you haven't read this, please make sure that you picked up your copy from Uncle Bobby's outside at the desk. But it's just kind of so delicious as an offering for us to. But it's not talking down to us. I think it's an actual elevation, an invitation to elevate the conversation, but to remain rooted in community and in Black people and Black folks. And so, as a person of color, but that is non-Black, I too felt welcomed to reading and enjoying and just kind of learning from the struggles of this community. And so I'm just deeply appreciative of that.
I'm smiling because when I was at 440 going through minutes, I started reading about bilingual education. So I was taking pictures of the pages. So I sent some to Edwin and was like, Edwin, listen, I don't have the bandwidth to look at bilingual education and it's not my area of expertise, but you might want to look at this because they're talking about your people. Come in here and see what these people said. Edwin, here's when I'm going to be here. Just meet me here. Meet me here. Come look at it.
Yeah, so I'll be getting these random texts, and I'm like, "Why is Kamika? I'm like, where are you?" And I was like, "Oh, okay, I'll be right there." And I went, and there she was, and I'm like, "How you get back here?" Like, she's like, "I have my ways." I was like, "Okay, okay, let me just trust. All right." Sharif, did you have any questions you want to kick us off?
I got
off
a ton
on?
Of questions.
Yeah, so, yeah. 99 questions.
Yeah, yeah. It's so funny. I'm so accustomed to turning off my phone, putting it away, and I'm like, wait a minute, my questions. I had to turn my phone back on. And, you know, I kind of want to start off in, like, you know, and Dr. Royal is a straight shooter, and so we're going to just, like, dive right in.
Okay.
You know, You know, one of the themes throughout the book is just this story of, you know, desegregation, both for children as well as adults. And, you know, a lot of times when people are thinking about that, they're thinking about the Deep South, right? Brown versus Board, Deep South. And, you know, as Malcolm used to say, you know, Deep South is everywhere south of the Canadian border. So what did, you know, like at this point, and even as you were doing the research, desegregation, is that a distraction at this point, or is it something that still should be invested in? Both for, from a parent's perspective with their student and child, as well as for staff?
I think it depends on your values and what you're going for. There's no way to have this conversation that doesn't sound like it's an indictment against someone who is for it, right? So you have folks like Nicole Hannah-Jones, who's a big proponent of school desegregation at this point. I saw Noliwe Rooks talking about school desegregation, right? So even in Segronomics, part of the reason when I was looking at, like, are we talking about Segronomics or are we talking about racial capitalism? And I was like, we're not talking about Segronomics because she's actually talking about desegregation at this and segregation, right? So for me, the problem is state-enforced. State-enforced. The state to whom we pay taxes has no right to tell people they should not have access to something, right? This is our government. This is, we pay taxes. Like, this is ours, right? So state-enforced. People selecting to educate their children in places with people who look like them and love them and speak like them and discipline like them and value them, I think, is wisdom. So I think it depends on your values. I am not a parent, right? But I have a lot of people who come to me with, like, hey, what should I do about this? And so a girlfriend recently in outside of D.C., her daughter was starting school, and she had three schools as options, and so she's asking me which one, but she's also on some sort of, I don't know, listserv or some parent group or something for her county. And they're telling her, and her daughter's going to kindergarten, and she's like, but this school, the STEM school, is supposed to be the best. And I said, well, what makes it the best? And she said, well, they turn out people in STEM careers. I said, they turn out people in the fifth grade. What do you mean they in STEM careers? You leave the fifth grade and you an engineer? Everybody should be going over there. What you mean? Right? So I'm asking her, what is it that you really want? You told me you like this school, even though it didn't have as strong ratings, but you like this school because the teacher, her teacher's black, the principal's black. When you walk into the school, you feel loved and welcomed. Your daughter feels loved and welcomed. You about to give that up for what some people said on the internet, right? For a STEM school, which, and there's no shade on STEM schools, but you have, to me, you have to ask yourself what it is you value. And what you want your children to walk away with. And I'm saying this as someone who experienced a very racist school that I talk about in the introduction to the book, that conservative, allegedly Christian school I attended for elementary.
Building off of that, I want to jump back into some of the historical pieces of the book, and particularly like the Mark Shedd era, you know, I'm thinking about the 1967 student walkouts, you know, a pivotal moment, right? A flashpoint, a major flashpoint in, and I think not just in education, but in the history of Philadelphia as a city.
Yeah.
And that comes to life in the book. And, you know, I think you describe, if I remember correctly, like the liberal failing of Mark Shedd's administration.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered if you could talk about that, because I'm thinking about Sharif's question about desegregation and where we're at with that now. But I'm thinking about these other solutions or attempts, right, that were still white-led. You know, the gaze, the framework was still white. You know, are you seeing, like, what you thought of that kind of failing? And if you could talk a little bit about that. But also, you know, do you see similar patterns in, like, reform movements today? Speak frankly, please.
I don't know why you would ask me. I don't know how to do that. You know, I don't doubt that Mark Shedd was a good guy who wanted to do good things, right? But it's also where we get this idea of, like, the liberal do-gooder. He did not just he, but I'm thinking about Richardson Dilworth, too, right? So former mayor turned Board of Education chair, You want to shake it up. You want to make everything so liberal. But you keep putting these same white folks in these positions, right? And I think about that when I think about Marcus Foster, right? Because what a lot of times people like to say, we can't find, you know, people who do such and such. We don't know where they are. Philly had Marcus Foster, mm-hmm. right? Philly had Bernard Watson. Philly had these people. And they, you know, the white liberal leadership at that time chose something different. And we know, you know, what happened with Marcus Foster when he left here. You know, the book, the title itself, On Working White Liberals, right? So it's an indictment. It's absolutely an indictment against white liberals, which, you know, when we have these dichotomous conversations, then people are like, oh, well, then that means you must like the conservatives. Actually, no. No, right? Like, I need you to move. Keep going to the left. Like, keep going. Keep going. Keep going. Keep going left. Keep going left. Yes, I mean, I see it. I was in Teach for America. You know what I mean? Like, what? Oh, goodness. Who is it? Beth Sondell and Carrie Kretschmar had that article from a few years ago mm-hmm. where they looked at all the different networks of Teach for America and the different teaching fellow organizations. And it was a whole web of all these different organizations. And so I do think a lot of that, you know, it's been repackaged, yeah. This type of liberalism. And I think, you know, a lot of times people do have good ideas and then money gets involved, right? And who the money is coming from and everybody needs money to operate. Like, you can't operate for free. So, you know, it's a thing. But I do think that we keep seeing a lot of the same stuff mm-hmm. over and over again with better technology.
And throughout the book, you're, you know, again, speaking about, you know, black educators who knew their craft, right? Like, it's yeah. not just this idea of, oh, you look like me, so now as a student, I'm just more motivated. Like, that's, the role modeling has a thing. But yes. There's also instructional expertise that
Absolutely.
They will bring in to it, which is different than a lot of times as people are thinking about teachers. They're like, all right, we're going to work on content. And then tomorrow we're going to do a 2-hour workshop on cultural proficiency where, you know what I mean? And then next we're going to build a relation. Like, no, that's good instruction. And mm-hmm. if you're separated, then it's bad instruction.
Mm-hmm.
How, you know, as you're thinking about that, how would you reimagine educator prep programs? A lot of times it's like teacher prep. No, I'm talking about the principals. I'm talking about, like, what professional development do board members go to? What does, you know, superintendents and their cabinets, like, everyone, because it's not just who leads the classroom, it's who prepared them, in quotations, mm-hmm. and who's in the ecosystem.
You want us to talk about this Board of Education? Is that what you asked
yes.
me?
Yes, yes. Let's,
well.
Yes. Because throughout the book, it shows, like, how many decisions and everything, right? Like, they're...
I mean, first of all, I think the board needs to be elected.
Oh,
period.
Well.
I think the board needs to be elected. It is the only, if unless I'm mistaken, it is the only school board in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania that is appointed and is not elected.
I wonder why that is.
I understand that was the case until Pittsburgh became elected, I think, in 1976. So Philadelphia is the only one, right? I don't know. And so I was speaking about the book a few months ago, and a community member said to me that, you know, she was concerned, and I think rightfully so, about dark money, you know, seeping into and people taking over school boards. And I hear that concern. But we also, the city council has, what, 17 seats?
Mm-hmm.
There's 7 councilmatic districts. Is it 7? Because I don't live here anymore. I might be misremembering. 7, right? And there's 10 people at large, or is it flipped? Is it the other way?
One of them.
It's flipped? It's
Come
10?
On, y'all live okay. in Philly. Answer that question. You know?
There will be a test at
10
the
districts
end of the presentation
and 7
here.
Citywide. So here's the thing. If you can have 7 people run citywide for city council, mm-hmm. why can't you have 7 people run citywide for the school board? I don't understand that. Like, I get that the 1950, the home rule,
home
charter. Yes, that would have to change. I get that. I don't understand why we act like why it's okay for Philadelphia not to elect its school board when every other school board in the Commonwealth, it just doesn't make sense. Like, what are you then saying about the people of Philadelphia?
Mm.
I just, that's weird for me, okay? And perhaps then I think once it's elected, then we can have a different conversation about how board members are trained and all that sort of stuff, right? Now, what's that? You asked about teacher prep and principal prep.
Reimagine. But I do want to say, I'll be transparent. I'm glad your answer pushes me to rethink. First, I was with school board, I was just like, oh, yes, I did recognize, like, hey, they're treating Philly in this way. But I was also, what you opened up with, like, I was like, if we have an elected school board, Philadelphia's white progressive, white liberals are going to take that joint over and just... But you've also given me something else to think about, you know?
I mean, maybe, but I mean, you know, I'm a fan of some people too, right? So, like, I'm a fan of Kendra Brooks, right? Where did Kendra come from? Kendra came from organizing for schools. I don't know what Kendra was doing before that. I met Kendra in the context of organizing for schools. And where is she now? She's on city council. So I feel like, you know, the progressive, quote unquote, people, because I don't know how progressive they really are, but, you know, I don't know. Now, in fairness, I don't live here, so I could be totally off. I just feel like, why not trust Philadelphians with the destiny of Philadelphia? That's the position I take. Maybe it's not a position for me to take because I don't live here, but I don't know. I feel like Philadelphians are smart people who can figure out, you know, what they want.
Can we keep going with this conversation? But I do want to come back to the other piece of your question, Sharif, but... I mean, the other underlying piece and one of the threads in the book is just community control.
Yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, it's white supremacy. It's racism, right?
Yep.
It's structural racism. It's racial capitalism.
That's why you my people.
I know. We fam.
Exactly. But, go ahead.
You know, I think at the end of the day. And so, you know, the push has historically, right, been for some form of community control. Absolutely, I think, yes, an elected school board, some kind of system that's participatory, democratic, community-driven.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, could you say more about your thoughts about community control? Is that something we should be continuing to aspire to do? I think I'm thinking from, like, I, too, stood alongside Kendra Brooks in, like, organizing and doing educational justice work here when I first came here, and... I'm just trying to think about, is that the path, right? Will that, like, if we continue on at least the movement work, I guess I'm trying to think about, is that ever going to take hold, or, you know, what's your take on that?
I don't know that I think there's one path.
Okay.
You know, I think it depends on what goals you're trying to get to. I mean, I believe in self-determination. I believe in community control. I believe in people having a right to say what kind of education they want in their community and for their children, right? The problem, again, becomes, like, those things can also be co-opted, right? So community control can easily become, well, they're not from our neighborhood, they shouldn't be in our school, you know, that sort of thing. Like, I think about the gerrymandering of, what's the little special school? Penn Alexander.
It's so gerrymandered. Even her name changed, right? Like, you don't even know who Sadie is anymore. It's like now Penn. I'm like, I thought it was named after that black woman. Nah.
Penn Alexander, right? So the neighborhood, right? And the configuration and how if you're in the catchment area, at one point, I haven't looked at the data for a while, but the homes were worth 200,000 more in the catchment area than outside.
Still true.
Right? And the first year height was here and the families were still lining up with the tents and everything to get the kids into the kindergarten. Right? That school, and then I look, when I'm looking in the minutes, I see that the University of Pennsylvania gives them an extra $750,000 every year. Like, you know, so I feel like there's ways community control. Some people have community control, right? Mm-hmm. But who gets to have it and who then, you know, needs somebody to tell them what belongs in their, you know, community, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We can be very paternalistic when it comes to education and schooling and community.
So I still want to jump back to, you know, so let me a little context. So how I've been thinking, how I experienced school and education, it was almost as if, not almost, like the school that I attended as an elementary school student, independent black school, it was almost like, yeah, you can get certified, Penn State, wherever, but the community has to certify you too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, like the community, like that's part of your hiring process. Mm-hmm. And so just when I'm thinking about that, but I'm also going back to the previous question, like how would you reimagine educator prep? The context of what you researched, the things that you saw, like, yo, why the heck did they move away from this? This is working. This would have this would have changed the trajectory of our city. How would you imagine ed prep?
Well, let me say first, Sharif, everybody don't want it to work.
A lot of paychecks come from it not working, right?
From things being broken that you can keep tinkering with, right, forever. Right? There's a Tyack and Cuban have a book, Tinkering Toward Utopia, right? 100 years of school reform. So you spend all your time, it's something to play with. You know, it's never what it needs to be. So I think there are
looking
folks,
busy.
Absolutely. I think there are folks who are deeply invested in performing reform, but not actually, you know, making things better.
That's a commitment right there, performing reform.
Oh, yeah, honey, it's a whole show. you asked the question. In terms of teacher prep, I mean, that's an interesting question because I'm in a teacher prep. I teach in a teacher prep program. What would it look like? You know, right now, one of the things I like about the program where I work pre-COVID was that all of our students, no matter what class they were in, spent time in schools. The problem with that, though, is that a lot of times we were sending people into schools, but we weren't a part of schools. So we become a burden for school districts. Right. And we're not, to me, we weren't giving enough to districts. So, you know, I live in Baltimore, my university's in Baltimore, I live in Baltimore. And they'd be like, well, what are you going to do some extra professional development for the people at the school? And I'm like, is who going to do extra? Am I going to do? I'm not this institution. This institution benefits from sending our students to that school, right, to learn something from those teachers. This institution owes something to these districts. So, you know, I would love to see more partnerships between universities and in ways that are not parasitic, right? In ways that aren't just our students get to learn like this is a lab and sort of suck the schools dry and then walk away. I do think that we teach things in a very sort of fragmented way. I also think that universities are generally so concerned with dollars that there's a lot of things that I feel like we don't check in students and in their preparation, you know. But I'm also looking at districts like, you know, one of my girlfriends, her son doesn't have a science teacher. His science teacher comes on, he's at school, and the science teacher is at another school, and they got to all go to a room with a substitute and watch science on Zoom because they don't have a science teacher, right? So, which is another real concern. And somehow we want to do everything but find more money to pay
that
people.
Sounds innovative. It's distance learning. I mean, what do you want? Like,
Personalized,
yeah. Uh-huh. So I was like, what you doing science today? He's like, I don't know. I really couldn't hear the computer well today. No. So, you know, I think there has to be a concerted embeddedness and there has to be sort of a unification of the entities. But oftentimes I feel like our schools are so stressed trying to make so many different things work that it's not necessarily worth their time to spend time with us who are in the universities. You know, it's just, it becomes another thing and not something that they're really going to benefit from, right? So I think that we actually have to ask people in schools, what would you like to see from the graduates we're turning out, right? What can we do better so that they're prepared when they get over there? But, you know, I'm also not, like, I'm not into all the, like, ultra testing and let's do all the test prep and test the kids to death. And so if they start talking about you got to be able to read all the spreadsheets and, you know, are you on the cusp and are you on the bubble and all of that. And I'm like, I mean, learning, yes, but testing kids to death, no.
I think another piece to this conversation that I'm wondering about is decentering or abolishing the kind of foundation of both teacher prep and a lot of those standardized testing and all of that, which is whiteness. I wondered if, I was curious as to your thoughts on like, what I'm thinking about is the content of both what our students are experiencing in their classrooms, but also what our teachers are experiencing in their preparation. Because the reality, right, I think as all three of us know, and I'm sure many of us in this audience know, is that, you know, these teachers aren't actually prepared to work with the young people that are presented to them, you know, come September or, you know, that first day of school. You know, I don't think there's a silver bullet, but I wondered, you know, what are your thoughts on, for Philadelphia, but I think urban education in general, you know, what's some of the work that needs to be done there? Or maybe there's things that you're already doing in the context that you're working at Loyola.
Shrink that question down for me a little bit.
So I'm wondering about just like in the preparation, right? Mm-hmm. Like what's at the heart of our teacher preparation? Let me say it that way.
Okay. What's at the heart? What should be at the heart or what is at the heart?
What should be at the heart?
What should be at our heart is turning, so for me, I want to turn out little rebels and revolutionaries. I don't care. I'm serious. I don't care where they go, teach. So a few years ago, I had a young white woman I overheard say, you know, I want to teach in an urban school. And I was like, what was that? And she didn't want to say it again. And I was like, you think I'm mad that you don't want to go teach in an urban school? I don't care. Like, if you don't want to go, don't go. Right? Go home. Go home.
Go home.
Go home. Go back to your community. But I want her to go back to her community challenging white supremacy. I want her to go back challenging notions of classism and consumerism and ethnocentrism. Right? I want her to go back home challenging the idea of, you know, America. You know, a student told me my second year at Loyola, you know, love it or leave it. And I was like, good luck. Good luck trying to get me out this joint, because I'm here to stay. So I think we should be turning out young people who know how to, who understand the fundamentals of teaching, although there's some things that you don't really know until you start doing it and you screw it up a couple times.
Yes, yes.
And then you start to get your practice together. But on top of that, who are humble enough to know that they have to still be teachable, who are willing to learn from their students and walk in knowing they don't have all the answers. I think we have to start turning out teachers who actually love children. Mm. I think often, when I was still living in Philly back in 2013, so, you know, the fall of 2013 was a very tumultuous time for the start of schools, there was an open letter in the Daily News. And I saved it, right? The teacher in me was like, oh, I'm going to save this open letter. And I use it as a teaching tool every semester by this lady, Miss Wilner. Now, I'm not telling Miss Wilner's business. Miss Wilner put her business in the Daily News, okay? Y'all can Google it. And if, wherever she is, I hope she's, you know, okay. I hope she's having a good day. She was a teacher at Pinnell. And it was the beginning of the school year. She was very upset. She starts out talking about, it's an open letter to Mayor Nutter and Governor Corbett about, you know, show me how to run my classroom with 32 students. 24 of them are boys, and they run around, and they're cursing people out, and they're throwing things, right? Now, whenever I show this letter to people, they're like, oh, my God, like, is this a new teacher? And I'm like, y'all, Miss Wilner had been teaching for 30 years, okay? Plus, it was like the second week of school that she wrote the letter. Now, I spend a lot of time with elders. I'm like, maybe she tired. Yeah, I be tired. So I'm middle-aged. Sometimes I be like, you know what? I'm too old for this. Right? You can definitely feel like I need a break. Like, I'm not into this foolishness. I don't know what y'all are doing. But that's also the point when I need to step aside from some things.
Right.
Right? And we have far too many people who don't love our children in these classrooms, you know? And they know it. They can tell. So I'm like, if they throwing stuff, I ain't never had a child who knew me throw something at me. Who knew me? Now, I did have some who didn't know me. I'm not even going to hold you. One time I was like, I don't work at this school, so I'm going to be real cool right now. So I don't know how this is going to go. But, I think we need people who actually have the capacity to love our children. You know, unfortunately, we don't check for that, you know? Yeah. So we have some people with microphones. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Now, President Kennedy, he was a white liberal. He was asked about education. He said, the role of education is to prepare our children to the new frontier.
Okay.
Right? Now, President Kennedy was talking about the American new frontier. Now, we could use his statement as education should, we should prepare our children to pave that road that is not paved for them. That's number one. The second thing, Hillary Clinton, a white liberal, she was asked about sex education. She said that the goal for sex education should be that we convince our children not to have sex until they are 21 years old. Now, we, the working poor, we cannot afford that our children to be promiscuous. We cannot afford that our children to have early sex, to have sex too early. Because when they have sex too early, the biological priority of the brain changes.
I'm so glad you asked her that question.
So, I think it sounded more like a comment than a question. Sex education, the children shouldn't have sex until they're 21. That's what I heard you say, right? I mean, I believe in bodily autonomy, so hopefully we are equipping our young people with enough information about their bodies that they can make informed decisions about what they engage in, and enough love for themselves so that they're not outside looking for random people to affirm what they have and who they are.
Mm.
And so if we're doing that, then they can make decisions about when to engage in that way. Thank you.
So I was a, you've talked a little bit about some of the historical kind of context of education in Philadelphia. So I was a product of the desegregation system. And that's where, if you were a black child, the thought was if you to get a better education, that you had to get that in a white neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And so what we experienced is a feeling from the community and the teachers that we didn't really belong in that neighborhood. And friendships that we may have had in the classroom weren't the same friendships outside when parents were at the gates looking to see who their kids were playing with. And so just thinking about, that part of our educational journey, is there a way that you think we could have gotten that situation right or we could have done that better?
School desegregation is a white people problem. So when I hear you talking about, is there a way we could have done that better, I feel like white people could have not mistreated children of color who were sent to their schools. I don't know any other way to say that, right? And this is documented, not just in Philadelphia, but in multiple places, with people throwing rocks at buses, or in Philadelphia, children who were sent to desegregate schools being called the bus kids, and they were, kept intact in one class. I don't know how to tell people to do that better except to be better human beings, right? I don't know. So part of the reason why I don't feel like, oh, we need to desegregate, is because I feel like, why do we need to keep subjecting black and brown children to people who mistreat them? Why do our children need to be guinea pigs? And again, I'm saying that. So the school I went to for elementary was very white. I talk about this in the intro of the book. Not a black adult anywhere in the building, mm-hmm. right? But they terrorized my sister. And I use that word intentionally. Mm-hmm. My sister is now the other Dr. Royal. She is associate assistant vice president. I can't ever remember her title of something at Michigan State University. So she turned out fine, but they terrorized my sister. And it has taken years for her to see herself differently from what her fifth grade teacher did to her, right? Mm-hmm. So why would we, I just can't wrap my mind around why we would send our children to people to mistreat them. Why do our children have to be, Hercules at 6 years old? Like I don't know, while we spend so much time trying to coddle and protect white children, all this stuff about critical race theory is all about protecting white children, mm-hmm. right? So the whole world bends to protect white children and black children, what? Right? We come out the womb just supposed to be ready for war? Like, how does that work? Right? So I think that they just should have been better. I think many of our parents were doing the best they could, mm-hmm. right? Believing that people would treat their children better, that they would be better human beings. And unfortunately, many of those people at the schools just weren't. You know, many of them just weren't. I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad news. Y'all look sad. I mean, you asked the question. I'm sorry.
So I kind of am curious to continue the conversation about the desegregation, especially because in our current situation, I think a lot of the focus is on, you know, white parents, just send your kids to the neighborhood schools. And, you know, it's almost like the opposite side of things where they're putting pressure on white folks, which is the way that it should be. But how do we talk to folks who are not in this room right now, who don't see the value in that, to encourage them to take that step and say, yeah, go visit your school. The teachers there are wonderful. There are these wonderful communities that we should be a part of. How do we bring more folks into that conversation? And should we?
I think that's a lovely question that's not really for me. Because, I mean, just quite honestly, like, so I, at the Institute, for my, I'm trying to think of a nice way to say this. I don't think enough about how to convince white people to invest in black schools. You understand what I'm saying? It's not something I think is my burden. I'm interested in schools with black children having the resources they need, having the teachers they need. I'm not interested in convincing white people of anything, quite honestly. One of y'all have something for the telling the white parents? I got nothing. I'm empty.
The only thing I would say, Sharif. If they do go, if white people do go to schools that are have, you know, children of color in those communities, it's already gentrified. Don't also gentrify the school. Don't gentrify the Home and Schools Association and start a Friends Of. As soon as I see Friends Of, I get a little, my hair starts sticking up.
Because
I'm like, black people didn't used to call it Friends Of because they weren't Friends Of, it was their school, right? Like, because schools don't have communities. Communities are supposed to have schools.
Yeah.
Right? Not Friends Of. My mom ain't never called, I'm the friend of this school. It doesn't even sound right in our language.
And it's also, it reinforces inequity. And I'm saying this as a Central High graduate. So when, 2013, and you have all these people laid off and all, the funds cut, and Central's building a new library, right? And even when I was going through the minutes and I'm looking at the Friends Of, and I'm like, I get people wanting to have the best for their children, but we all benefit from having an educated society. So everything, again, I don't live here anymore, right? But it breaks my heart. So as someone who does live here, we spent some time sort of looking at information around the students who were in elementary school when all those cuts were made in 2013 and 4,000 people laid off, right? And how old they are now. And where are they? Now, I'm not, I don't know. I can't say for sure that these are the same people who are armed.
Mm-hmm.
And, right, with the carjackers. I can't say for sure. But they are that age.
I just wanted to add, I think, is it white people problems? Is that what you
That's
said?
That's what I said.
Yeah. I'm like, 100% yes. And part of the issue is that white people problems, we're trying to solve white people problems with white solutions. And the fact is that, and that's what, I mean, to me, that's part of the book, right, is that it's not just about including black voices back into the history, but actually asking ourselves to rethink our entire framework for how we think about high-quality neighborhood schools for every single child in Philadelphia. That point blank. Like, this is what we need, right? This is a funding issue, it's a racism issue, it's a gentrification issue, so on and so forth, right? But if our conversation is about inclusion, that doesn't get at the root of the problems. And so for me, it's like, well, we need to think about what is our goal, right? You mentioned that earlier, Dr. Royal. And what are our strategies to meet said goal, whatever that might be? And if, in fact, the goal is to have high-quality neighborhood schools for every single child in the city of Philadelphia, then we're going to have to reframe our whole mindset about this is the kind of work that we all need to be participating in. So, like, everybody should feel welcomed at the school, right? Even, because everybody who paying taxes is contributing to keeping those schools alive, right, and thriving. We have a collective commitment to that. So everyone should feel welcomed as this is a community space. And how we, and so we have to like look, like reframe what the roots of our solutions are. So like, let's look at the Black communities and the Black voices that are in Dr. Royal's book to think about, you know, I'm reading, I'm like, I'm seeing the values of mutuality, interdependence, self-determination. Those are the goals, right? Those are the strategies. Because it's not about like inclusion, but actually thinking about, you know, how am I relating to my neighbor, whether they're Black, brown, whatever. You know, what's that work that we have to, like, that internal work that we need to do, but also community work. This is neighborhood work. And so we have to commit to that. And I think, you know, everyone has a different role to play in that. But I think if we can have that kind of shared commitment, then we can just start. That's just, like, the starting point, I think, from my perspective.
You're going to be the last question.
The last word right here.
Thank you for talking to us today. It was very illuminating, but I'm kind of asking a question that feels very theoretical and possibly a little bit conspiracy theory-ist. But no, my question is, every time I hear anything about schools, it very much sounds like people are purposely trying to ruin the idea of free government education, because like when I hear about, you know, the rules that teachers have to go through and all the things that are taken away from them and the poor pay and the, you know, purposely taking out the mask mandates when kids are getting sick and, you know, just everything just seems very much like we're really trying to ruin the whole idea of public education. That's what it seems like to me. And I just kind of wanted to get your feeling on, in a general sense, what you feel like America is doing with public education.
I mean, yes, that's the short answer.
There's no conspiracy there. I think these are just facts.
Yeah, I mean, you know, under the last sort of president and the federal government putting Betsy DeVos in charge of the Department of Education, right? I do, and now the book bans. Right, and in Virginia, you have a hotline to call and report your teacher if they say something about race or Black people. So yes, I mean, but we've also seen this before, because Virginia is a state where for 5 years, I think it was Prince Charles County shut down its schools so as not to desegregate, mm-hmm. or Prince William County. So I mean, we see these plays over and over again in response to me, from my perspective, in response to people who are Black and brown, who are getting a little bit more of what people see as the American sort of ideal or the American pie. You know, I think there are people who feel like, wait a minute, I'm supposed to be doing better than you, you know? Okay. Mm. All right, so I'm trying to respect the people's time. It is 8:33. Thank you all for coming to join us. And I'm going to go sign some books upstairs.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.